Quaker.com. Today is Tuesday, June 5th, 2012, and this is podcast number 157. My name is Ben Stone. So in yesterday's podcast, I focused on the interview with Bob Wenzel and Gary Johnson. And, you know, I guess there's quite a bit of a storm across the internet over that interview. And, seems like I was just one of many voices that that spoke out about it. And oh boy, I'm not going to spend the whole podcast talking about that today. There were a couple of things that I just wanted to emphasize, and I took a little bit of heat, not much, but a little bit of heat yesterday because I guess it seemed like I was picking on Gary Johnson. I really didn't mean to be. I feel sorry for him getting caught unprepared and getting hit with questions that he was not, not capable of fielding. But I blame him. I don't blame Bob Wenzel. And a lot of people are attacking Bob, saying that Bob set him up or Bob was too rough on him or whatever. But I don't think so. You know, once again, let's assume you're a presidential candidate or you're a candidate for any particular public office. Well, first off, you should pick and choose who you're going to do interviews with. And if you decide to do an interview with a person who is a noted economist, has a website focused on economics, and is specifically very vocally one type of economics, being Austrian theory economics, if you're going to do an interview with someone like that, you probably ought to expect some economic questions. Now, if you're unequipped, economically speaking, then you should point that out, and you should say, "Look, I know this is I know you run an economic website, and your focus is economics, but you know, here's my record as a governor. Here's what I've been saying on the campaign trail," and you stick with what you know. You stick with what you've done. You stick with the actual accomplishments that you can speak about with confidence. What you don't want to do is portray yourself as something that you're not, or speak about things that you have no knowledge on. And I've talked before about fighting the state, and when you decide in your mind that you are opposed to the state and you decide to fight the state, there's any number of ways that you can do this. And one of the most common ways people think that they're fighting the state is to take on the legal system. Well, the problem with that is the state owns the legal system, runs the legal system. The state makes the laws. The state owns the judges. The state owns the police. The state owns every aspect of the legal justice system. And so why would you walk into their battlefield using the weapons of their choice at the timing of their choice and fight under the conditions of their choosing? That's crazy. And so often when I talk about this, I use Mike Tyson as an example. Now, Mike Tyson is past his prime, certainly, and he's basically a washed-up boxer. But even today, in his washed-up condition, if I was going to take on Mike Tyson, I would not take him on in a ring with boxing gloves. That even if I could magically transform myself back to a 20, 22, 24-year-old when I was in the prime of my health and when I was quite dangerous in a boxing ring at the time, if you could magically put me as a 22-year-old against today's Mike Tyson, I still would not go into the ring with the man, because that's his area of specialty. That's the thing that he is better at than anything else that he does in his whole life. And it's not my specialty. So how would I deal with a Mike Tyson? Well, I certainly wouldn't fight him in the ring. I'd wait till he's asleep and hit him in the head with a board or something. I never, ever, ever fight an enemy on their terms. And this concept that, you know, you want a fair fight. No, that's not a fight. If you want a contest where things are fair, that's called a game. But that's not a fight. A fight is where you go into it with the intent to win. And if you don't go into it with the intent to win, and not just like a game, but realize the seriousness of a fight. If you're not going to go into it with the seriousness to win, then you need to not look at it. You need to not go into it at all. So the same echoes out in other things in life. If you're going to go on to somebody's show, if you're going to go on to their radio show or their podcast or whatever, or you're going to go on to a TV show or whatever, or you're going to go into a debate with someone, the first thing you want to know is, what are their strengths and weaknesses? What can I expect from this person? And if they're going to be talking to you about, something else, let's say gardening. If I'm going to go on to a podcast with a master gardener, I'm a pretty good gardener, but I have quite a limited knowledge on some aspects of gardening. So I'm not going to try to portray myself as some kind of an expert when I'm talking to a master gardener. I will be happy to speak with one, but I'm not going to try to portray myself as some kind of expert. And if I'm talking to a master gardener and he starts talking about some specific person who's done groundbreaking work in the field, I'm not going to pretend that I know about that person if I'm completely unacquainted with their work. And that's exactly what Gary Johnson did here. Gary Johnson falsely portrayed himself. He lied about his knowledge and then attempted to cover it back up very poorly, I might add. And Bob just busted him on it. Good for Bob. Bob was far more polite with Gary Johnson than I would have been. I wouldn't have let him get away with half of what he did. I have very little tolerance for that kind of thing. And when I'm saying that kind of thing, I'm talking about deception and lies. I have very little tolerance. When someone, the moment I see deception is taking place, I generally will end the conversation. I'm done right there. I'm done. Because if you're not going to be honest, then we have nothing in common. We have nothing to talk about. We have no dealings. That's it. I've actually walked out of car dealerships just over that. One time, the moment that a car dealer begins to use deception with me, we're done. We're over. I'm leaving right now. And there's nothing that person can say to draw me back in, because I have nothing to say to a liar. And at this point in time, that's how I look at Gary Johnson. He went on Bob's show. He should have done his homework and at least figured out the kind of things that he's going to be asked. And if he doesn't know those things, no problem. Be honest about it. Say, well, I really don't know economics, but let's look at my history as a governor. Now, actually, since I said that, let's look at Gary Johnson's history as a governor. Gary Johnson did a really good job as a governor, as you're measuring a politician and their behavior. But if you really think about what he did as a governor, all of his actions as a governor, balancing budget and cutting government expenses and doing all the things that he did, vetoing all the different bills that came past him, all those things that he did are in line with a conservative. When Ron Paul talks, when Ron Paul's like on any of the major television stations and they ask him about being a libertarian, Ron Paul almost always corrects them and tells them that he's a conservative. And in the case of Gary Johnson, that's what Gary Johnson would have been wiser to do rather than label himself as a libertarian. The only thing I can see libertarian about Gary Johnson is his position on the drug war. That's about the only thing I can see in any way about Gary Johnson that is libertarian. He has liberal views on some things, but that doesn't make him a libertarian. He has, fiscally speaking, he's extremely conservative, so that's probably how he should have labeled himself. But either way, for him to just sort of vaguely keep referring over and over to, you know, to people that he's very, very familiar with at the Cato Institute and Reason, he keeps referring to those two organizations, but then he never refers to any individuals in those organizations, just vaguely referring to them as if they're people, and then openly saying that, yes, indeed, he had read Rothbard and was very familiar with the Mises Institute and their Austrian economics, and then to display very clearly that he was lying about that, you know, that goes right to character. And if I'm going to, first off, I'm not voting for anybody because I've gone into that over and over again, my opinion of voting. But if a person is portraying themselves falsely, does it really matter, you know, if they're Barack Obama lying, or if it's Mitt Romney lying, or if it's Gary Johnson lying? Does it really matter who the liar is? You know, like with the car dealer, as soon as the deception starts, for me, the deal is off. And at this point in time, you know, I would have nothing to do with Gary Johnson, period, under any circumstances, because a person who will deceive you on one topic will deceive you on other topics as well. And so I just don't do, I don't have associations with people who lie and deceive, if I can at all avoid it. Okay, now, and I wanted to read one other thing, because it popped into my head yesterday, but it was after I had already finished the podcast, that Murray Rothbard had talked about this actual topic. Of course, Gary Johnson wouldn't know that because, you know, in spite of his lie, he never read any Murray Rothbard. But Murray said in his book, Making Economic Sense, Murray said, and I'm going to read this, so it's going to use words that I'm not accustomed to using, so but forgive my my ignorance and my backwardness. It is no crime to be ignorant of economics, which is, after all, a specialized discipline and one that most people consider to be a dismal science. But it is totally irresponsible to have a loud and vociferous opinion on economic subjects while remaining in this state of ignorance. And again, that's from Murray Rothbard, Making Economic Sense, from 1995. And this is a really good book. It's been a while since I've read it, but I read it probably, I'm going to say around 2006 or 2007, somewhere in that time frame. And what struck me about it at that time was that it was very dated. Murray was talking about a lot of the things that were very contemporary to 1993, 94, 95. So that means he was talking about the so-called Republican Revolution, and he was talking about the so-called he was talking about Bill Clinton and the early years of Bill Clinton and early years of the Bill Clinton presidency, that is. And he was talking about the Newt Gingrich and their Republican uprising that was taking place at the time. And so a lot of the stuff in the book is very dated and very time specific to the mid-90s. And yet, and this is what struck me back when I read this, and yet the actual core of what Murray was talking about was happening in, I think it was 2007 that I read that, but the actual core of the events that Murray was talking about in 1995 were happening in 2007, but they all had different names and different faces. So the same shenanigans that were being pulled by the politicians in 1995 were also being pulled by the politicians in 2007. It was just different politicians. Sometimes, even, you could see that the party had flipped, but it was still the same shenanigans that the politicians were pulling. And the same lies were coming out of Washington, and the people were buying them with the same enthusiasm. So, I like the book. You can get it, you can download it for free over at Mises. You know what, I'll put a link on today's show notes to where to find it at Mises, over at Mises.org. You can buy the book, or you can, like many things at Mises, you can download it as a PDF, or they have it several other ways. I don't know that this one is on, I don't think this one is on audio. It may be, who knows. Mises.org is, for me anyway, a very difficult site to maneuver and find things on. But anyway, okay, so that was Murray's opinion, you know, that it's not necessary that everybody, that all libertarians or anybody really of any description has a vast knowledge about economics. But if you don't know about economics, don't try to portray yourself like you do. And especially don't go on an interview with somebody who is an economist and try to portray yourself as something that you're simply not. Okay. So, let's break and go in a different direction altogether, shall we? Over at lewrockwell.com, there's an article by Doug Casey. And let me just brag about Doug Casey first. Well, I'm not really bragging. I'm complimenting him, or that's my intent anyway. Doug Casey is a brilliant man. He is very successful in life. He has a wonderful idea that he's able to bring to life in South America. And I think he's really on the right track on a lot of stuff. I think a person could not go wrong in studying the writings of Doug Casey and listening to him speak and really giving an ear to this man, because he's extremely knowledgeable. He's very wise. And I should make a distinction here. You know, there's a lot of people that are really knowledgeable and they're idiots. But Doug Casey is very wise. He's very knowledgeable. And he has put legs to that knowledge and that wisdom. And he is, you know, he's going to make it through whatever he faces. Now, having said that, his article over at Lou Rockwell titled End of the Nation State, and I'll put a link to it in today's show notes on badquaker.com. But this, it's a good article. I like it. It's not a very long article. When I started it, I was actually hoping that it would have been longer and more in-depth, especially towards the end. When I was getting at the end of the article, I was thinking, man, Doug, you could have put on 4 or 5 more paragraphs here. You know, I really enjoyed the article. And I would love to meet Doug Casey. He just seems like he would be a fascinating individual to spend, you know, like a whole day just sitting with him and just letting him talk and just, you know, just absorbing what he has to say. Just asking him questions about his life and about his thoughts of the future and so forth. That would be like an ideal afternoon for me. However, now having said all those wonderful things about Doug Casey, there's some flaws in this article, and I can't help but to point them out. Above and beyond the flaws that I'm going to mention, I really want to emphasize that this is a good article. It only takes a couple minutes to read it. It's well worth the time, and it's well worth the effort. Please go to badquaker.com, hit that link, go over and read the article by Doug Casey. Now, in the article, The End of the Nation State, unfortunately, there are a couple of fallacies that the state has put great emphasis on teaching all of us. It's much like, you know, I was talking the other day about lies that were told about the Old West, about the American West, and how, you know, everything was, murder was rampant, and they were robbing trains right and left, and banks were being shot up, and all these things are lies. They were originally lies told by authors who wanted to sell dime novels and were willing to say anything in order to, in order to sell dime novels on the East Coast to people who had never been West and would never go West. So they could just pretty much make up anything and sell it to these people. And then later, these same types of sensationalism and exaggerations and so forth were picked up by Hollywood for the same purpose and with the same vigor as the dime novelists had done. And the state figured out at some point in time that these lies were useful for the purposes of the state. So government history books have been adjusted to more towards meeting, you know, the dime novels and the movies than actually portraying the West as it really was. And I talked before about, there's a couple on badquaker.com, I think it was like last Thursday or Friday or maybe both days, when I was talking about this, and I put links to wonderful articles that debunk all these myths about the Old West. Well, just like the state has lied about the Old West, and just like history books lie about the Old West, and just like modern conceptions painted by Hollywood and by novels and so forth, just like those are pretty much all false about the Old West, much of what we're told about ancient and medieval times is also simply lies made up by the state, lies made up sometimes to glorify events and individuals, sometimes made up to glorify the state itself, sometimes, you know, pushed by the state in order to perpetuate the myth of the state. But one way or the other, there are distortions and lies of what the past was really like. And unfortunately, Doug, in this article, it's clear that Doug believes some of these myths and lies, and he places some of his projections of the future, unfortunately, based on these misunderstandings of history. So I wanted to touch a couple of them. The first being the idea that, let me just read a little bit of it here. And again, in reading this, you know, these are not my words, so oftentimes when I read someone of this intellectual capability, I don't, they use words that I don't use, so forgive my clumsiness and my awkwardness as I read someone else's words. This is the section that is named The Industrial Revolution and the End of Kingdoms. And Doug says, from about 12,000 BC to roughly mid-1600s, and by that he means 1600s AD, or current era, however you want to put it. Anyway, back to his work. From about 12,000 BC to roughly the mid-1600s, the world's cultures were organized under strong men ranging from petty lords to kings, pharaohs, or emperors. Now, I want to break off there, and I'll get back to reading this same section in just a second. But what I wanted to point out in this is his flawed understanding of that time frame. And I've done several articles talking about the birth of the state, Jericho, and what was happening around that time. So if you've heard some of this before, just stick with me. I'm not going to really emphasize a lot on that. I'm just going to go past it. But ancient Jericho was the first known example of the state. It appeared about 11,000 years ago, or roughly 9,000 BC. Prior to ancient Jericho, there is no evidence of any state existing in any form. Jericho is the absolute oldest settlement that we have ever found any evidence of, where we have evidence of a state existing. Now, that's not to say it's the oldest settlement. There are lots of settlements older than Jericho. But Jericho is the first settlement where we see the key things that had to be there in order for a state to exist. And we also have actual physical evidence of the state, and that being a skirt wall and a defensive tower. Prior to Jericho, we do not see settlements with skirt walls and defensive towers. But in addition to that piece of evidence, the other evidence that we have that the state was birthed at Jericho is the fact that prior to Jericho in roughly 9,000 BC, settlements that you see anywhere that you find them in the world, settlements would typically involve farming communities, evidence of trading, evidence of advanced pottery sometimes evidence of metallurgy. But you would not see the overproduction of grain. You would not see walls and towers. You would see homes, but you would not see walls and towers. This is the stark difference. With the overproduction of grain, you have two things that can happen. You have instantly, you have taxation is possible with the overproduction of grain, and you have slaves that are possible with the overproduction of grain. If you don't have the overproduction of grain, you do not have the possibility of having slaves. And with the overproduction of grain, you can have taxation. You cannot have taxation prior, because we're talking about prior to hard currency, you know, money being like gold and silver and so forth. Prior to that discovery, grain was the and best form of taxation, best as far as the state's concerned, that is, not as far as the farmers were concerned. So that's what we have at Jericho, roughly 9,000 BC, about 11,000 years ago. We have this instantaneously, we have this birth of the state, and we don't see the state appearing anywhere else on the face of the globe for another 2,000 years. So the state existed in Jericho for 2,000 years without any evidence of the state existing anywhere else. And that's one more piece of evidence as to why we know that the tower in Jericho indicated that there was a state. Because if there was another city-state nearby, then it would make sense for the regular people there to have a tower for defensive purposes against some invading state. But there was no invading state. As a matter of fact, the tower was too small to hold anything more than maybe as little as 20 people, maybe as many as 50. So in a valley of thousands of residents, only 20 to 50 of them could actually defend themselves in this tower. So that means it was not a defensive structure to defend the people of the valley. It was a defensive structure to defend the state against the people of the valley. The state, at its very birth, was nothing more than a gang of robbers who had decided to stay in one place, who had found it easier to fortify themselves in one location and ride out from that location and rob and return safely to that location, rather than going out on highways and raiding in that fashion. Now, if we go back to that point, 11,000 years ago, when the birth of Jericho took place, like I said, there's no evidence of a state prior to that. But there's many things that we have evidence of. For example, 40,000 years ago, there have been multiple musical instruments found in Germany from about 40,000 years ago. People were literally making and playing flutes and music in Germany 40,000 years ago. Now, that's not evidence of farming or a settlement, but having a musical instrument is a sign of prosperity, and it's a sign of culture. However, we do see farming in New Guinea about the same time. Now, just because there's no evidence of farming in Germany doesn't mean farming didn't exist. It just means that there were no massive fortifications. There was no, you know, there was none of the scars on the land that would stay for 40,000 years and give us hints that they were there, which also indicates that there was no state. Because, you know, scarring of the land is one of the key characteristics of the state. So we have prosperity going on in Germany to the point of where there's, the spare time to create musical instruments. And that generally comes from having a farming culture. The true hunter and gatherers, you don't have a whole lot of spare time, but once you begin farming, then you begin to have more and more spare time. So finding musical instruments, finding flutes in Germany is indication that the people there were prosperous and they probably had spare time. So and if there was farming in New Guinea at roughly the same time, you can probably assume there was farming in Germany as well. Well, where you have farming, you have permanent settlements. Now, the first permanent settlements that we know of in Europe, this is what we've actually uncovered, and we can stand there and point to it and say, right here it is, was about 30,000 years ago in the Czech Republic. That's not that far from Germany where the flutes were found. But we're still talking about roughly 20,000 years before Jericho. Roughly 20,000 years before Jericho. Now, keep this in mind. Jericho was only, 11,000 years ago. But for 20,000 years, there were settlements without a state that we can prove, that we know of. So, if there was no state, now what does that mean? How can you have a settlement with no state? And what's the real difference here, and what's the flaw in what Doug Casey was talking about? The flaw is that the idea that you have to have a strong man, that you have to have a king of some kind of a thug that runs an organization of some kind. No, that's called crime, and that's what the state is. The state is basically just the most successful crime gang. And we don't have any actual evidence of that existing until Jericho. Now, that's not to say there was no crime, and that's not to say there were no thugs or there were no gangs. But clearly it wasn't enough of a problem. It wasn't enough of a problem to make any kind of major attempt to put up defensive structures. So, in all likelihood, any kind of that, any activity of that type was a matter of small roving bands of thieves that would strike a community and then not stick around, because obviously the community would do something about it. So once again, until that group settled down in one location, which happened to be the rocky outcropping at Jericho, that's the first evidence we have that gang of thieves would have settled down into one location and robbed out from that location rather than roving and robbing, hit and run, and move from place to place, hoping not to get caught. So for 20,000 years that we know of, humans existed in farming communities without the state, without any kind of compulsory leadership, if we want to put it that way. And keeping in mind that compulsory leadership has to have a structure around it to defend it from those that are being exploited, if we can put it that way. Because, you know, if you just think about it, if there's just a big shot who happens to be a bully and pushes people around and taxes them, if he doesn't have some method of defending himself, somebody's going to cut his throat in the middle of the night. And that's actually, if you read The Art of Not Being Governed by James C. Scott, that's exactly what you see among the mountainous non-state people, is that as soon as someone begins to develop into some type of a proto-state, some type of a proto-king, some type of a, you know, more than just an honored tribal leader, when they actually start to express state-like authority, someone just kills them. And that's why that, you know, the logical progression then for the thug is to build some kind of defensive structure. So, you know, at this point, I need to break. I just noticed the time, and I've run past my time when I was supposed to do the commercial. So I'll be back in 2 minutes. Hang in there. I'll be right back. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug-out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from BadQuaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help BadQuaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support BadQuaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do you do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. Okay, so thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. And let me give a real quick commercial for Porkfest this year. Today's the 5th, and on the 18th of this month, Porkfest will begin in New Hampshire. The New Hampshire Porcupine Freedom Festival will begin. And I'm going to be there with my badquaker.com motorhome, and you'll see the badquaker.com banner probably on the front of the motorhome if I can set it up that way. And I'll be in site number 82. If you're thereabouts, drop by and say hi to me. Now, anyway, back to the topic at hand. So we have, from the time that we know that settlements were taking place in Europe, that was about 30,000 years ago, and we know that farming was taking place in New Guinea about 40,000 years ago, and we have evidence that farming was taking place in Germany about 40,000 years ago, and it wasn't until 11,000 years ago that the first evidence of the state appeared. And during that time, and this is what we know to be the case, there was farming, there was advanced pottery, there was art, there was jewelry, there was music, and there were settlements pretty much all around the world without any evidence of a state. There was seed exchange. There are people who are geeks, who are seed geeks, who trace the history of specific varieties of seeds. And the distribution network of seeds prior to the existence of the state is amazing. Now, I mentioned the overproduction of grain a minute ago. About the time that the state appeared at Jericho was the exact moment that the overproduction of grain took place. Prior to the existence of the state, the farming areas, pretty much everywhere that we can find evidence of farming, you have a variety of farming things that were farmed. You have animal husbandry going on, and you have shepherding going on, and you have a variety of different things. Specifically in the Jordan River Valley, where Jericho is located, you had figs, you had grapes, you had hemp, you had poppies, you had all kinds of things being grown as crops. But then when the state appears, that all narrows down, and you start having the overproduction of grain. And so that's one of the characteristics that you have of a state, is that, because as I was saying, grain made an easy method of taxation. Prior to the state, individual farmers had what might be called stash holes, or you might say they were, like a root cellar or whatever. It would be a spot that you might hide things from thieves that might come around your farm trying to steal something from you. But more likely, it was just a place in the ground, a dugout place in the ground, to store a year's worth of goods so that you could make it through a bad year, or so that you could get it through the winter. But when the state appeared, all of a sudden you have less and less of those, and you have large storage areas protected by the walling activity of the state. So it's where they were actually taxing mostly the grain, and then bringing it back in and guarding it away from the people who they had stolen it from. And then the use of all this grain to feed their slaves to do what? To build stronger walls, to keep them safer, to feed their armies that would now go and rob other communities so that the state could actually reach into other, like in the case of Jericho, you can only rob so much from the one valley there in Jordan. So if you have enough of an army, you can move over the mountains and rob the next valley over. And you can then begin to, expand out your area of influence further and further away. But you're limited on how far you can go with that, just due to how far men can march and how whether or not you have horses or whatever as transportation. So that's the real image of what we have in ancient days. And it's not at all this image that the state wants us to believe, where slowly strongmen were recognized in the village, and then the next thing you know, they were a little bit stronger, and then they were a little bit stronger, and pretty soon, in order for everybody to feel protected, they gave more and more of their rights over to this small group of people who slowly became kings and in the state and so forth. That never happened. That's a vision of history that just didn't take place. Okay, let me read the rest of this thing here before I run out of time. The Industrial Revolution and the End of Kingdoms. From about 12,000 BC to roughly the mid-1600s, the world's cultures were organized under strongmen ranging from petty lords to kings, pharaohs, and emperors. It's odd to me, at least, how much of the human animal seems to like the idea of monarchy. It's mythologized, especially in medieval context, as a system with noble knights, fair princesses, and brave knights. Oops, I read that wrong. Noble kings, fair princesses, and brave knights riding out of castles on a hill to right injustices. And then he says it was actually quite different from that. I'll just breeze through this. They were more like little Tony Sopranos, or perhaps like little Stalins. The princesses were unbathed hags, he calls them. The knights were not more than hired killers, and the shining castle on the hill was nothing more than a headquarters of a concentration camp with plenty of dungeons for the politically incorrect. Well, there's not as much evidence of that as you would think. Sure, there were, generally speaking, you would have a place to lock people up in a castle, but really and truly, like I was saying a second ago, the castles were not concentration camps. The castles were where the state went to hide from the people. Okay, back to Doug's thing here. He says, with kingdoms, loyalties weren't so much to the country, a nebulous and arbitrary concept, but to the ruler. You were the subject of a king first and foremost. Your linguistic, ethnic, religious, and other affiliations were secondary. It's strange how when people think of kingdoms, when they think of the kingdom period of history, they think only in terms of what the ruling class did and had. Even though, if you were born then, the chances were 98%, okay, now here's the flaw, now hear this part. Even though, if you were born then, the chances were 98%, you'd be a simple peasant who owned nothing, knew nothing, beyond what your betters told you, and sent most of his surplus production to his rulers. But again, the gradual accumulation of capital and knowledge made the next step possible, the Industrial Revolution. Now, at this point, I need to point out the flaw here. This idea, this is kind of like almost a cartoonish version of it is in Monty Python's Holy Grail, where the peasant is sitting in a mud puddle digging for worms, and the king comes riding up, and they begin their classic conversation between the peasant in the mud pile and the king. And this is, that's the personification of this myth that the state likes to portray. The state likes us to think today that what we have is so much better than what it was in the medieval times, because they were just sitting around digging through mud eating worms back then. Only the king was living high. Well, when in fact, Doug is right when he says that they were unbathed and this kind of thing. To a certain extent, that's right. You know, if you think about the table of King Henry VIII, we imagine it today. We see it in movies where he's got a turkey leg in his hand and he's, you know, big piles of food and he's engorging himself. Well, first off, they didn't have turkeys in Europe in Henry VIII's day, so he couldn't have been eating a turkey leg. But in addition to that, things in Europe at the time of great rarity were like pepper. That would have been a great luxury to have pepper with your meals. Spice-wise, they were extremely limited. Whether you were a king or a peasant, you had salt. That was pretty much it. That was the magic spice. That was it. Very few people in Europe could afford anything beyond salt. So, yeah, life was pretty rough. Even for the king, it was not all that great. On the other hand, and Hans Hermann Hoppe has probably done more work on this, more work to shine the light on this than anybody else I'm aware of. But if you read Hans Hermann Hoppe's book, Democracy, the God That Failed, and also if you can get your hands on The Impossibility of Limited Government and the Prospects of a Second American Revolution. Now, this is a much shorter piece. It's actually more like a paper. It's not a book. But you can get, if you look that, well, maybe I'll put a link to it on the badquaker.com so that you can get a hold of that, because that's not all that common. On the Impossibility of Limited Government and the Prospects of a Second American Revolution. In that, and in Democracy, the God That Failed, Hans Hermann Hoppe very clearly shows that medieval life was not the way we're told. Your peasant was not rich in any way, but on the other hand, the peasant faced no taxes, no taxation of any kind. The European peasant was not a slave. The European peasant stayed in one location because it was most economically viable for him to do so, but he could at any time leave. He was not an owned individual. The noble class, on the other hand, there was this friction between actual kings and the noble class, and the king was simply the richest of a group of nobles. He was usually the richest relative of a group of nobles. And at all times, there was this friction between the nobles and whoever the king was. There was loyalty really was secondary in the whole thing. The poorest people, the peasants themselves, would have felt loyalty towards the king simply because the king did things to win their loyalty and maintain their loyalty. He would have big feasts for the peasants, and he would, you know, hand out free things and stuff like this, he being the richest of the local nobility. But there was always this friction between the other nobility and the king. And the king would pit the peasants against the other nobility to keep the nobility in check. And the nobility would constantly be scheming among themselves on how to kill the king and replace him with one of them. So this was a process that means that most of the peasantry had no taxation whatsoever. Now, if they lived on the land of a nobleman, then much like a sharecropper, a good portion of what they grew on the land belonged to the nobleman. But it was the nobleman's land. They were employees. Now, this is not a whole lot different than if you're, you know, if you work in a bicycle factory, you don't own the bicycles that you produce. You make a living off of it. The owner of the bicycle factory pays you enough of his income that you can make a living. Otherwise, you would go someplace else. But you don't own everything that you produce when you work at the bicycle factory. And medieval times was no different with farming. You didn't own 100% of the production of the farm that you worked on because you didn't own the farm that you worked on. The nobleman owned the land. And if you wanted to own land, you had to go outside of the reach of the nobleman. And that was possible. You could do that. People did it all the time. The problem was, now you're going into a country where there's likely, you know, the big problem with Europe in medieval times was that there were wolves. There was a breed of huge wolves that didn't really get exterminated until way late, almost near the birth of modern states, around 1600 or so. I can't remember exactly when that huge wolf went extinct. And I'm not sure. There may still be some of those big wolves in the Pyrenees. I'm not sure one way or the other about that. I was thinking they were extinct, but there may still be some remaining somewhere. But that was a major problem. If you're going to go out and go off into the woods and try to start your own farm and be a free person like that, you're going to face all the difficulties. You're going to lose all the advantages of being under the agreement with that nobility, the things that he was providing for you, things like already tilled land, things like ready-made buildings and housing and so forth, stuff that he owned that he was providing for the people who worked on his farm. If you wanted to, you could go out and try it on your own, but you just had to carry all the difficulties and all the risks yourself rather than having the nobility do that. Baggy is smacking at the microphone right now and hitting it with her nose, so if you hear interruption, that's what's going on. She's wanting me to go feed her, but I need to finish up this podcast. Come on, Baggy, give me a break here. Give me like 5 minutes, okay? All right. Let me see if I can get back to my notes. Now, when you're thinking of these things, you really need to, Doug kind of threw all of the kings and emperors and everything together, but you really need to see empires and kings differently. The empires did pretty much function the way Doug Casey's talking about there. Everybody got taxed in an empire because the empire was, that's kind of what it was. An empire is far more like where everyone is a slave, where the medieval system was not. There were slaves, but typically the slaves were owned by the nobility and or the king, and they were more like house servants and that kind of thing. But the peasantry were not slaves. On the other hand, with empires, pretty much everybody was a slave. And so that's why you need to think of them differently. And that's the thing about the modern state. You know, slavery was done away with most places in sometime around the early to mid-1800s. That's at the same time the state was really coming into its maturity, well, into its modern phase of its maturity. It still has further to go to mature, but into this stage of its maturity, it was moving into that stage in the early to mid-1800s. And at the same time, chattel slavery was disappearing, and the reason why is because we were moving out of the early stage of the state, moving into the modern stage of the state where everyone is a slave now. So we don't have slavery in the sense that we had slavery in the early 1800s, but at this point with the state, everyone is a slave. Even people inside the state, even people inside government are still slaves to the state. So this was a trade-off that took place where the peasantry was actually far more free in medieval times than they are now. And the reason why is because of that transition. We went from having a certain groups as slaves to this transition where now we are all slaves. And if you don't think you're not a slave, the classic definition of a slave in the olden days was that your travel was limited. You couldn't just come and go as you pleased. You couldn't travel long distances without written permission of some kind to take with you to prove who you were and to whom you belonged and how long you were going to be there. And when you were coming back, you weren't allowed to just go wherever you wanted like that. Next, the most obvious thing was slaves were not allowed to be armed. If a slave was found to be armed, unless he specifically had the permission of his master, he was likely to be killed on the spot. And slaves were pressed to look differently than the free classes. So, for example, in most of history, and there are exceptions to this, but in most of history, slaves had their heads shorn and their faces shaved for the males. And decorative things like earrings or other piercings or tattoos were signs of slavery oftentimes. But there was some kind of a physical markings to prove that a person was a slave. Well, that's pretty much what we're moving towards right now. We're moving towards everyone having some type of a identification to prove that they're a slave, and they have to have that identification to move around, and they are not allowed to arm themselves in the ways that they would like to. That's where we're at. And that's why I say peasants were not slaves in medieval times. They were not even taxed. But now, the slave class has been eliminated in the sense that it was in the early 1800s. And now all people are slaves. And if you don't register properly, or if you attempt to look differently, or if you attempt to weaponize yourself, you will be singled out and you will be gotten rid of. Well, that's all the time I've got. I've got to get up there and feed Baggy now, because she's going to start getting destructive if I don't obey her. Who's the slave there, huh? For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And if you're at Porkfest, be sure and look me up. Thanks a lot for listening to my podcast. Goodbye, folks.
I'm so excited about Porkfest this year.
Porkfest? What's that?
It's the Porcupine Freedom Festival, a fun and educational camping event put on every summer by the Free State Project. This year it's going to be happening June 18th to the 24th at Rogers Campground in Lancaster, New Hampshire.
Okay, I like camping and I definitely like freedom, but my budget is tight.
Tickets are only $30 for the whole week if you get them before May 1st.
Well, that sounds reasonable, but what goes on there?
What doesn't go on at Porkfest? There are speakers, family fun, dance parties, karaoke, a comedy roast, hiking, campfires, sports, a wedding, and all kinds of delicious food. But the part that I like best is spending time with other people who love freedom.
That's sounding pretty good to me. Where can I go to learn more?
Check out porkfest.com and make sure you spell pork like a porcupine. PORCFEST.com. Like what you see?
Looks like a blast. Okay, I'm in. See you at Porkfest.
While you're there, check out how you can become a VIP, very important porcupine, for a modest donation. See you at Porkfest.